Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And we begin with our weekly Ask the Mayor series with Mayor Bill de Blasio. And as we've been announcing, this will be the last Ask the Mayor until the November election, because we're heading into the serious campaign season. And it would be unfair to other candidates to keep having the mayor on once a week. Of course, we'll invite Mayor de Blasio, or if a challenger beats him, we'll invite that person to get the series going again after the November election. And listeners, last call for Ask the Mayor, for now, at least. Mr. Mayor, I can tell you as you join us this morning, and good morning, that this series has apparently become such a success that before I give out the phone number, our lines are already full.
Well, Brian, I want to thank you. I think it's been a tremendous experience hearing from so many New Yorkers calling in with, you know, every kind of concern. And I think it's been very good for the civic discourse in this city. So I commend you.
And I commend you. And I thank you, really, for being accessible to our listeners for the last year and 4 months since you started coming on. I know people appreciate being able to ask you questions directly, and also hearing you in longer than soundbite form, which is something that we like to offer elected officials and others as well here as much as we can. So I'll start with a follow-up from one of those listeners, and then we'll get to the phones. When you were here 2 weeks ago, you promised to come back with more information and a policy response to a listener who's active in trying to get more enforcement of the law against electric bicycles and have it focused on finding businesses rather than the delivery people who work for those businesses. And I understand you did follow up and you have a response now. So do you have a new e-bikes policy to announce?
Well, I'm ready to say we're going to move for city council legislation to change the approach, because I think the caller was right that to penalize the delivery people and not those who employ them made no sense and obviously wasn't working sufficiently. I want to be clear, despite a really imperfect law, the MIPD has been increasingly cracking down on e-bikes. There's been three times as many confiscations of e-bikes in the last year than the year previous. And that's good. But what we came to realize after the caller raised the concern is that the law is just, it's too vague. It does not make enforcement of the business logistically practical. It's not tough enough. So we will engage the city council, and certainly other stakeholders will talk to the business community, the restaurant community, et cetera. But I want tougher legislation. I want a law that makes enforcement easier and more straightforward and directs the enforcement at the businesses that employ the delivery bicyclists. So that's the shape of things to come, and I'll be getting to work on that with the council in the coming weeks.
So what would that mean then specifically? Stiffer fines for repeat offenses, or what would you be proposing specifically?
Right now, it's a very circuitous law that makes it hard to simply say, okay, here's the employer. We're going to fine the employer directly like we do in so many other situations, and it's going to be a substantial fine that then increases with any kind of repetition. That's the model we need. We just don't have that, but we can repair that with city legislation, and I think there'll be a lot of receptivity in the city council to get that done.
I know that one of the caller's concerns was that the law is in place, or a law is in place, but the NYPD hasn't been enforcing it very much. Like, the NYPD considers it not worth their time compared to other things that they could be spending their time on. So maybe we need a new law, but maybe what we need is a directive from you for the NYPD to take this more seriously.
Well, I want to challenge that assumption. Again, there's been three times as many confiscations of bikes as in the previous year. It's about 700 that have been confiscated so far in 2017. So I think NYPD has been focused on it. It's unquestionably, look, there's a safety concern that goes along with these e-bikes. There are other challenges NYPD addresses that may be even more critical, but this one's very real. But when you have a law that makes enforcement difficult and makes it unwieldy and less effective, it does not encourage, you know, putting as many resources, as much energy into the enforcement, because it doesn't work the way you need it to, right? I mean, it's, there's a little bit of a concern here that when we apply the energy of our officers, we have to know that it's going to have a substantial outcome. So, yeah, there has been enforcement, but enforcement that is hindered by a law that is not workable enough and not strong enough. But the good news is we can fix it. So in terms of democracy, Brian, you know, your caller raised a concern directly to me. That caused me to ask a lot of questions internally about what was working and what wasn't. That led to us understanding that we needed a new piece of legislation. And in fact, we have the ability to get that new piece of legislation working with the council. So you're going to see changes on this, I think, in the near term.
Let's take a phone call. Lynn in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with the mayor. Hello, Lynn.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Hey, Lynn, how you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I first want to thank you so much for the 80-20 affordable housing program. And my family has been applying for that for a while. And both my husband and I are freelancers. And as freelancers, the program is really not set up to address the situations of self-employed people or freelancers. We've continually been told we're too high, too low for the same income bracket that we're trying to get into. And, you know, like for somebody with a purely W-2 income, they say, you know, give six paychecks, whereas for a freelancer, they're looking at 3 years. And they're also, they don't take into the account that a freelancer's pay does go up and down, and that their expenses go up and down. So an expense that I had, you know, 2 or 3 years ago is not necessarily an expense that I have now. And so I've been through a huge process with several of the companies and with HPG talking back and forth, and Corey Johnson's office has tried to help us out. And it's just, it's been kind of crazy making. You know, I give paperwork and they say that I haven't.
I get it. I get it.
Mr. Mayor, go ahead.
Yeah, Lynn, thank you for raising this, and it's an important point. I mean, look, first of all, the affordable housing plan, this is part of the plan to create and preserve 200,000 affordable apartments. So that's going to be enough for 500,000 New Yorkers. And we've done about 78,000 so far in the last 3 years have been either subsidized or financed to be affordable for the long haul. But the good news is it's not actually an 80-20 program anymore. We passed a law with the city council to mandate and any new development that requires a city permission that developers must provide either 25% or 30% affordable housing, depending on the income levels involved. So that old idea, 80-20, we actually have surpassed that as a matter of law in this city, and we have the most progressive affordable housing law in the country now. But your point about freelancers is very well taken. We've been working with the city council on a number of pieces of legislation over the last few years to recognize that we have more and more of an economy based on freelance work, and yet our laws do not recognize it properly. And we're making some major adjustments, and I think you're right. We need to continue to make adjustments, including with our affordable housing plans. I want you to provide your information to WNYC so one of the folks from our housing department can talk to you directly. I would only note, I think if income fluctuates a lot, that may cause us to need to have a longer time frame to understand what income looks like for you. But that should not stop us from being able to say, here are the things you do qualify for. And we're producing a lot of affordable housing at different income levels, so there should be matches that you should be competitive for, you should be able to apply for. So I want our folks to talk to you directly and sort it out in your case, but also use your example to learn from so that we can make other adjustments to include folks with freelance income.
Lynn, I'm curious, is there any way when you're applying for these affordable housing income categories, because your income fluctuates as a freelancer, where they could look at, let's say, a five-year average of what your income has been? Is there a mechanism? Is that lacking?
What's tricky is that as a freelancer, like I'm a freelancer with a growing business. So like we had you know, did a lot of business expenses a few years ago that we don't have now. We're making different kinds of money now than we did then. So really what I did is I got my accountant to write, you know, who I've been with for many years, to kind of write a statement of what she would calculate as my income. And they were not accepting that even.
I see. So that, okay, we're going to use that. Hopefully the mayor's office will use that to inform exactly what they look into. So thank you for that. And I'm going to move on to Sally in Brooklyn. Sally, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Mr. Mayor. I'm a tenants' rights attorney working at a large legal nonprofit that's receiving grants from the city. And my question relates to the overall strategy in the fight for affordable housing and preserving affordable housing, particularly your commitment, Mayor, to protecting rent-stabilized units. I'm really excited about the right to counsel and the major changes that are probably going to come with it as a result of the new legislation. It's really a historical achievement. But what I'm concerned about is, as far as I can tell, the right to counsel legislation and the city agencies that will make referrals to it aren't going to be prioritizing rent-stabilized units. Will your administration take a closer look at how the funds are being spent to ensure that the lawyers getting the grants can spend time fighting for these cases? It often takes a lot longer to fight a rent-stabilized, to protect a rent-stabilized unit.
Sally, thank you for the question, and your question's very timely. Today, I'll be signing the right to counsel legislation, and it is historic for the city. It literally says that any New Yorker threatened with illegal eviction by an unscrupulous landlord or harassed by a landlord or deprived of repairs, deprived of heat and hot water, has an opportunity to get legal assistance. And for all New Yorkers whose household income is up to $50,000, they will have the right to a city-financed attorney, so literally get an attorney for free to defend their interests in housing court. We believe as this program builds out, it's going to serve as much as 125,000 New Yorkers a year. So it's a very, very big deal. And, you know, this is something that people have been working for years and years, and it's finally going to become law today. Look, I would say to you that my full understanding is that we want to do a lot to help folks in rent-stabilized housing. It's well over 2 million New Yorkers. Often it is folks in rent-stabilized housing who bear the brunt of these kind of actions by unscrupulous landlords. So, you know, I'll have, again, be happy to have our folks follow up with you directly if you give your information to WNYC. But my full understanding is that's very much a part of our targeting and, in fact, an area where we can get a lot done because of what rent stabilization law gives us in the way of tools that then we can help the tenant fight with by giving them a free lawyer.
So to follow up on that caller, and to inform people who don't know the issue, council has passed a bill for funding lawyers for low-income tenants in housing court, where there is such an imbalance of who gets legal representation. You will sign that bill? You're committing to sign that bill?
Absolutely. And you know, I've been working closely with the city council, and this was a very good process to figure out a way. And again, something people have dreamed of for years, that we could actually stop evictions en masse if there was legal representation provided by the city. It took a lot of work to figure out how to get it right and make it sustainable, but we got there. And now this is going to be something that New Yorkers can depend on. They can know they're going to get legal assistance if they're threatened with eviction.
And sometimes the landlord is the city. So you're okay signing a bill that includes the city paying for lawyers to oppose it in court?
Yeah, you know, it's an excellent question, Brian. And, you know, when this first was brought up, I asked people, how are we going to create both fairness but also make sure that the public sector trying to provide affordable housing, for example, through our public housing authorities, through NYCHA, that we can make sure we're getting things done the right way. And we came to the decision that if we're running things the right way, there's no reason there shouldn't be representation for tenants, for residents. And it also creates good accountability. You know, it's an encouragement to everyone up and down the line to do things right, knowing that the resident will also have legal representation. So, yes, we will be holding ourselves to the same standard.
I also want to follow up on the first caller, whose question, of course, was about affordable housing, which I think, as you would agree, the most common call that comes in during these Ask the Mayor segments.
Absolutely.
Right? On affordable housing, if we did not give any direction or plant any ideas about what else we might talk about, it would be affordable housing, affordable housing. So in a political context, and as we move toward campaign coverage here, the Democratic primary for city council in Crown Heights seems to have become, to some significant degree, about opposition to your plan to develop the Bedford Avenue Armory for a mix of market rate and low-income housing, and seems to be representative of the kind of pushback that maybe has surprised you citywide. In this case, there are fears it would lead to too much gentrification. That, of course, replicates a lot of other neighborhoods' objections. Both candidates in this primary are opposed to the plan, but incumbent Lori Cumbo, as I'm sure you know, is taking heat from challenger Edie Fox for not opposing it earlier. Now, Politico New York reports that you and your team are quietly helping Cumbo win re-election with operational and other assistance. So my questions are you officially endorsing Lori Cumbo for re-election? And if not, does it mean your model of affordable housing development has become a political liability such that you can only help a favored candidate behind the scenes?
Let me first speak to the armory and then to your question about the campaign. Look, this is one idea of many all over the city of how to address the need for more affordable housing. And I think what is being left out of a lot of the discussion is what people at the community level want in these kind of situations. The armory itself has not provided a benefit to the community and would be turned into a recreation center available to the community, made accessible financially to people of a whole range of incomes in the community. We're talking about a huge recreation space that has been yearned for a long time. And, you know, we had the same exact situation in other parts of the city where you look at these hulking buildings doing nothing anymore, these vacant armories and not serving the community. And here is a way to actually have a sustainable model that would provide a permanent, huge recreation facility, particularly for the young people of that community. I think there's a whole lot of people in Crown Heights and surrounding neighborhoods who want that kind of thing. Obviously, a lot of affordable housing would be created. That is not going to be created if you don't have some context to build. Well, you know, that's what we have to be real about. People want affordable housing. They want to know they can stay in their neighborhood long-term and in the city long-term. Our obligation is to subsidize as much of the existing affordable housing, protect it with things like free lawyers to stop people from being evicted, stronger rent laws, which I want to fight for in Albany, but also to build new affordable housing. And this is one of the ways we do it. So I think there's a lot of people in the community who, when they look at all of the specifics here, are going to like the pieces, understand that a certain amount of private development is necessary to fund all of it and make it sustainable. To the political dynamics, look, I think every neighborhood is different, and I think every specific development project is different. We had a big citywide, or I should say neighborhood-wide discussion in East New York, Brooklyn, about that proposed rezoning. It went on for a long time, well over a year. And ultimately, a lot of people in the community came to believe that the affordable housing that would be created, the jobs that would be created, the new school space, the new open space was all ultimately worth it for the community, and the city council member there voted for it. So I think what we need more of is an honest dialogue and a detailed dialogue about what each specific idea, what each specific project will bring to a community and what the community needs. On the campaign issue, look, I have to date not gotten involved in hardly any city council races. And I have to make a decision as we get a little closer as to whether to get involved. That's something I'll decide as we get closer. Right now, of course, we're focused on my own campaign. We're about to start debates, as you know. But there's still time to sort that out. I think in the end, most people in most districts want to know, where is there going to be a longer-term solution on affordable housing? They understand that there's going to be a certain amount of private development in New York City. They want to see it balanced by some real guarantees of affordability and something long-term that people can rely on, and that's what I'm trying to provide.
Are you supporting Lori Cumbo's campaign behind the scenes, even while not endorsing her publicly?
I am not supporting anybody in that race at this moment. There are people in my world who know her very well and like her and of their own volition are helping her, and that's perfectly normal, not surprising in the political context. But again, I'll make decisions on whether to get involved in that or any other race as we get a little closer.
Danny in Rockaway Park, Queens. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor and Brian. My wife and I love all your shows.
Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, congratulations for surpassing the 1 million ridership mark on the New York City Rockaway and Brooklyn Ferry service. I'm asking you directly since I've already been in contact with one of your representatives at City Hall and the New York City EDC, and so far I had no responses on my request for the necessity of installing a kiosk information board at the Rockaway Landing. I'm a big ferry advocate, as you probably know already, so I'm often at the ferry terminal. People arriving have often ask me where things are located, like the beach supplies, the surfing beach, oh, where's the wildlife refuge, Jamaica Bay? And I think a kiosk would be a real benefit to all. So I'm just asking you if it's possible that you can get this accomplished, because there's plenty of space or room there to do this. And it would, as the people come in, they're actually confused. Where do I go? We have Rockaway Park. We have Rockaway Beach. Where can I get something to eat? I think that would be a benefit.
Well, you know, there's a phrase, when you're right, you're right. So, Danny, I think this is a good idea. The Rockaway Ferry has been a huge, huge success. We've actually added a whole lot more capacity to it because it's been so popular. But I agree with you, and I've been out to that exact ferry landing, and there is space there. And I'm absolutely convinced from talking to a lot of people who have used it that you're right. They need more information to orient them and to recognize all the things they can do while they're out in the Rockaways, all the stores they can go to, restaurants they can go to. We want to encourage people to spend their money while they're there. So I will direct the EDC to put such a kiosk in. I think this is a fine idea.
Danny, I think you just got yourself a campaign promise there.
Thank you very much.
Danny, thank you for your call. We also take listeners, as many of you know, questions for Ask the Mayor on Twitter. Just use the hashtag AskTheMayor. And here's one that's come in that also represents something that keeps coming up since the first time we talked about it on an early Ask the Mayor. You directed the police department kind of ease back on the way they enforce some quality of life crime, so there aren't as many arrests, more summonses for small things. But people have complained that turnstile jumping was not included in that category. And similarly, turnstile jumping, I believe, is not one of those things that you would protect people for if they were arrested for it in the Sanctuary City program. Correct me if I'm wrong. So here's a question that has come in on Twitter that says, I guess my question for the mayor, after a series of tweets that this listener gave us, is how can you justify condemning turnstile jumpers when the MTA can't assure working machines?
Okay, a lot of pieces to what you raised. I'll try and break them down quickly. No, first of all, turnstile jumping is not one of the offenses under city law that triggers cooperation with ICE. There's 170 offenses. The information's available online. You can see what they are. They are serious and violent felonies and major crimes. Certainly, turnstile jumping is not one of the ones where we cooperate with ICE. We have been reducing steadily the number of arrests for turnstile jumping. I think the reduction in arrests is about 21%, if I remember correctly, in the last year for fare evasion. We're more and more going to summons as an alternative. Let's be clear. People shouldn't evade the fare. They just shouldn't. I understand the MTA is broken. That's why I've proposed a millionaire's tax to get a lot more money into the MTA and also to provide half-cost fares for folks at or below the poverty level. And I think asking millionaires to pay a little more so everyday New Yorkers can have a better subway and low-income folks can have a half-price ride makes a lot of sense, and I'll be fighting for that in Albany. But in terms of turnstile jumping, people shouldn't do it. Let's be clear about that. We're never going to turn a blind eye to it. The fact is, if someone does it once, they're not going to be arrested. They're going to get a summons. If someone does it a lot of times and there's a record of consistent recidivism, that's where you run the risk of arrest. Or if someone, God forbid, has a weapon on them or commits some other kind of crime at the same time. But we have been steadily reducing the number of arrests overall by the NYPD in many, many quality of life areas. And the way we're training our officers now is to say, hey, look, with any kind of quality of life crime, if a warning will do, use a warning. If a summons will do, use a summons. Arrest is actually the last resort, not the first resort. So I would say to folks, look, we got to work for the kind of structural change, like the fair fare that we could do with the millionaire's tax, that really will address the part of fare evasion that might be related to someone's economic circumstance. But not everyone who is jumping the turnstile is doing it because of economics, I assure you. And it's still not appropriate. And so we're still going in force, but less and less with arrest.
What do you think in general of the DAs in the boroughs looking now to revisit a lot of small crimes and reduce the offenses from the ways they were originally charged?
I think there's a very healthy effort going on here in this city. I think we're one of the cities leading the country now in everything from reducing mass incarceration. You know, the population on Rikers has gone down 23% since I took office, and obviously we're going to be closing Rikers Island, on through to using summons much more than arrest and reducing the number of arrests. And remember, NYPD has been driving down crime for 4 years now while reducing arrests, while increasing gun seizures, and that's all because of neighborhood policing and a strategy of much deeper communication and partnership with communities. And then what you're referring to just in this week, you know, four of the five DAs working with the NYPD agreed to cancel low-level offense warrants that were older than 10 years. So you've got hundreds of thousands of outstanding warrants for low-level offenses, nonviolent offenses that were hanging out there and creating, you know, a lot of concern because folks had those hanging over them, but they were not major issues. There was a decision with four of the DAs and the NYPD to literally cancel all of those. It was hundreds of thousands of warrants that now are in the process of being canceled, and it will mean a lot of people will not have to suffer because of that. This is all pointing in the same direction. And what's amazing, Brian, is that I think we were all sold a bill of goods for many years, you know, and this was particularly true during the stop and frisk era, that the only way to keep the city safe was with a very aggressive, high-intensity policing with lots of stops, lots of arrests. Turned out it was actually the exact opposite that was true. The best kind of policing is the kind of policing that is deeply communicative with communities, officers trained to engage communities, build trust, build relationships. And a lot of arrests is not actually the way to get crime down. We are proving it more all the time. So this reduction in the warrants is very consistent with that overall philosophy.
Campaign question. Because of suspicions that you do too many favors for big donors, Republican candidate Nicole Malliotakis is calling you on your promise last year to release a list of major donors who you have not done favors for or turned down for requested favors. You said it at a news conference and never delivered, and then said you would publish an op-ed on it, and you never have. So what do you say to Nicole Malliotakis and anyone else who's been following that unfulfilled promise?
It's a pretty small thing in the scheme of things, but I still intend to do it. I want to do it the right way to explain what I'm trying to say, and I think there's been ample evidence. You've seen a lot of very detailed reporting on all sorts of individuals who tried to get certain outcomes from the government and were rejected in those efforts. I will put it together in an op-ed. I will help to make that clear. But, you know, I think the bottom line here is we have to be straightforward about the fact that if we live in a society where you're going to go through a political campaign, you're going to ask people for support in that campaign, the question really is, will everyone be treated fairly at the end of the day? And I've used ample examples from town hall meetings. I've done over 30 town hall meetings, for example, around the city, where people I've never met in my life raise a concern. A tenant raises a concern. A neighborhood resident raises a concern. And I literally right then and there will ask the commissioner of that agency to follow up personally and go meet with that resident or meet with that tenant or go to their building, go to their block. That's what I try to do in a wide range of circumstances. And then, Brian, the crucial question is, will whatever be done on the merits? And I believe that's been the consistent pattern. Sometimes people raise a concern and they're right. Sometimes they raise a concern and they're wrong. But at least they will get looked, you know, the issue will get looked at and there'll be a judgment.
Will you commit to publishing that op-ed before the Democratic primary?
I commit to publishing the op-ed, and I have to find the time to do it, and I'll try and do it as soon as possible.
Will you commit to publishing that op-ed before the general election?
Sure.
2 weeks before the general election?
I'm not going to get into micromanagement of the op-ed. It's a small thing, but I'll get it done.
Amy in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with the mayor. Hello.
Hello. Hi, Brian, and hi, Mr. Mayor. Mayor DePlazio, a few weeks ago, well, just now you talked about affordable housing, and a few weeks ago you talked about not necessarily giving to people who are begging on the street because that just because they're out there doesn't mean they're homeless. And, you know, I actually talked to some of the people I give money to. I know some of them. I'll give one example, a man who in my neighborhood who was, had been begging for a long time, and one day he was very happy. He said he was going to get, he had gotten arranged for housing that he was going to move into. And, but once in a while, he still is back out asking for money because he's not making enough to afford the rent that month. And so please don't equate homelessness with begging. Just because someone has housing, it doesn't mean that they don't still need to, you know, to ask people for money.
Well, that's a perfectly fair point. What I was trying to say is, and I think, again, every New Yorker who's been here a while certainly would recognize this point. We all know there are some very, very needy people on the streets. And we all know there are some people who are street homeless, meaning they literally live on the streets. And this is a particular tragedy that I want to talk about what we're doing about. But just to make the point, we also know there's some people who go out and just as a way to make money panhandle. And some of them do have other options in life, and some of them do have homes, and it's not just about poverty. And I just want to say, I mean, that's a real-life reality, and I think panhandling makes people uncomfortable. And our job is to try and create a dynamic where people don't have to. And I don't think people should want to if they don't have to, honestly. We're trying to provide so many different supports for people, starting with the fact that anyone who needs a roof over their head, the city of New York is going to find a way to help them. And someone who's street homeless, we've created the most intensive outreach effort ever called Homestat, where we will send a homeless outreach worker to any, if you call in 311, we're going to send trained workers to that location to talk to that person, someone who's homeless, someone who may have a mental health issue, for example. We're going to keep working with them for months or even years if that's what it takes to get them off the streets. And so far, that effort has gotten 700 people off the streets already, and we're going to deepen that. So that's my point. I know there's a lot of people who are desperately in need of help. We're going to give them every conceivable form of support, but I also know we've seen some people who are there for other reasons, and we have to be honest about that.
And we're not there yet as far as getting help for everybody.
Well, you know, I want to challenge that. I know we're not in a utopian society, but I can guarantee you, if you call 311 and you say there's someone at a particular corner on a regular basis, we're going to engage. We do have the resources for this. We're going to engage that individual consistently, offer them shelter, offer them food, offer them medical care, offer them if they need mental health or substance abuse services. That's happening right now in this city, and we do have the capacity to do that for anyone who is willing to accept that help.
Let me get in two quick ones before you have to go. Just about every political analyst I've seen is reacting to your proposal for a new stream of city funding for the MTA and subsidized metro cards for low-income New Yorkers, paid for by about a half a percentage point city income tax increase for just the top 1%, singles making $500,000 or more, couples making over $1 million, just a half a percentage income tax hike, city income tax hike for the people in the top 1%. But all the political analysts I'm reading say even if that is fair and right, there's probably no scenario in which you'll have the votes in the Republican-controlled state Senate. So this may look like good populist politics, but it's not realistic for actually getting money to the subways. Can you argue that it is?
Sure I can. There's never been a millionaire's tax for the MTA. There should have been a long time ago. The MTA, look, let's be very blunt about this. The MTA for years has done the wrong thing. They've been mismanaged. They should have invested in all the basic things that keep the subway system going. They didn't do it. And they also, to be fair, have not had the kind of consistent revenue streams they needed. And for years and years, taxes on the wealthy were cut and cut and cut, by the way, in Democratic and Republican administrations in the state of New York. And that's something that should be examined, why Democratic governors and Republican governors both kept cutting taxes on the wealthy. Times are changing. You've seen what's happened the last few years, not only in the city and state, Brian, but in the whole country. People are recognizing that the millionaires and billionaires are not paying their fair share. So a millionaire's tax is an idea whose time has come. There's tremendous popular support for this kind of idea. It is not just a huge amount of money that could sustain the MTA. By the way, the $500 million a year it would produce for the physical fixes for the NYPD, for the MTA, that $500 million a year could be used to bond. It could bring in $8 billion a year for the MTA for the kinds of major repairs that are needed for the long haul. The fair fare, that means that folks who are low income or at or near the poverty level, below the poverty level, would get a half price MetroCard fare. That's an idea that has tremendous support. I also would remind you that there's going to be a lot of changes politically in this state, and you could have a change in the state Senate, including in some of the special elections coming up soon, and certainly next November, given particularly all the frustration with President Trump all over the state. So this idea could come into being very quickly and could have an impact very quickly. I'd like to hear less punditry and more thinking about how we get it done. I fundamentally believe this is an idea that will be passed in Albany ultimately.
So you think the Long Islanders in State Senate Majority Leader Flanagan's district are going to pressure him for this?
I'll tell you what, one thing. They're not going to be paying for it. Let's be real about it. This is, remember, partly patterned on the tax I proposed originally for pre-K. Now, we got the money for pre-K from Albany another way, but we got that money because I proposed the tax and it forced the discussion. But this is a tax on New York City residents only, and I would actually argue a lot of the suburban representatives might say, you know what, they depend on the MTA too. Their constituents depend on the MTA, but they'd sure rather have it be paid for by wealthy New Yorkers, and there are plenty of wealthy New York City residents who could pay a little more in taxes so we could fix the MTA.
All right. I know we're over time. I wonder if you can give me 30 seconds on the president being in town for a few days beginning Sunday, his first somewhat extended stay in the city since taking office. Any special precautions or anything the public should know?
Absolutely. I'm glad you asked, Brian. The public should know this. Don't drive on Fifth Avenue in that part of Midtown. Fifth Avenue will be open throughout the president's visit. The NYPD has done extensive preparations working with the Secret Service, and they certainly are ready to handle anything and everything. But anyone who wants to actually get where they're going, avoid Fifth Avenue in the 50s and 60s, avoid 57th Street crosstown around Fifth Avenue, around Madison. You know, that's just a smart thing. Get around it, because for those 3 days, from Sunday night to Wednesday night, it's going to be really clogged up. But he, from what we understand at this point, is going to be essentially located at Trump Tower the whole time, and we don't have any indication of other events. And we're ready for it. We're certainly ready for it. It's not that different than when presidents in the past have come, for example, to the UN General Assembly and stayed at the Waldorf or something like that. If he doesn't move around a lot, it particularly makes it a little bit easier. But everything will be under control, but just avoid that part of Midtown for your own sanity would be my case to all New Yorkers.
All right. Well, that concludes our weekly Ask the Mayor series. For now, as we suspend it, to be fair to all the candidates in the mayoral campaign. Mr. Mayor, thanks again for all these weeks. You've even carved out the time when you were on the road. So you've been on from Chicago, you've been on from the West Coast, you've been on from Germany, and probably other times I didn't even know you were away. And if you're reelected, I hope we'll pick it up again after that.
looking forward to it. The people will have to make that decision, but if they do, I look forward to it, Brian.
Thank you very much.
Take care now.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, stay with us.